620-1320 WILS. They're calling it the silver tsunami, and it's not a good one. This thing is going to potentially have massive repercussions on our jobs outlook here in the U.S. Millions of baby boomers retiring every single year. Alexander Kolokotronis is a PhD student in poli-sci at Yale University, and he's analyzed this and a potential solution to what might be bad news. Alexander, great to have you on WILS. Are you there, Alexander?
Yes, hey, sorry about that. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. Hey, tell me this. What's, when you talk about the silver tsunami, what's the concern? What is the effect going to be on our businesses?
The specific concern is that there are 10,000 baby boomers retiring every day, about 4 million per year. And a large portion of those baby boomers are themselves business owners. And so what we're going to see over the next 10 years is 2.34 million business owners retiring. And that can affect approximately 25 million employees across the country. So effectively, the silver tsunami is the onslaught of baby boomers retiring over the next decade. And this poses a big problem for what constitutes the backbone of our country and the American economy.
And you say that many of these business owners, these boomer business owners, do not have a written transition plan. What usually ends up happening with their businesses?
So many with a written many do not, as you've noted, do not have a written succession plan. And an employee ownership consultancy called the ICA Group found that 87% of boomers do not have a written succession plan. And so the thought is that, they'll find either a buyer very quickly or they'll be able to pass it on to their children. But numerous reports show that anywhere between only 15 and 20% of businesses are passed on to children, and another 15 to 20% find a buyer.
And so, and what usually happens with this buyer?
So in many cases, either people don't find a buyer and that business ends up closing up shop, or the buyers they do find are high-end developers, competitors, and we've seen this in cities across the nation, cities like San Francisco, cities like New York City, and so on and so forth, where a lot of small businesses end up closing up, and what we see is franchises moving in and high-end housing developments. So this is something we're likely only to see more of into the future.
Talking to Alexander Kolokotronis, he's a poli-sci student, a PhD student at Yale University. And what do you plan to do once you're done with school, Alexander?
I'm looking into doing a combination of academic work and teaching as well as policy work. And so, in a sense, trying to do a little bit more of the same of what I'm doing right now.
In your pieces in the In These Times magazine, you talk about worker ownership and this concept that many people may not have heard of. Now, how would that work exactly?
So there are a number of ways that could work. There's already an existing infrastructure for converting businesses to employee ownership or transitioning into some form of employee ownership. So, for example, since legislation in the 1970s, over 11,000 businesses across the country have become employee-owned. And
what's their track record, though?
Their track record is actually very good. It's something that we've seen as constant. It's something that also Ronald Reagan himself was promoting. He spoke of employee ownership as sort of the next phase in the American economy. Mm-hmm. And we've seen businesses as big as Publix, which has about 200,000 employee owners, thrive in the South and in Florida in particular. And we've seen other businesses, for example, such as Cooperative Home Care Associates, another worker-owned business in which employees effectively govern the enterprise according to one worker, one vote.
Okay.
They've been around for approximately 30 years.
So is this
2000.
Is this something where you need a business that's relatively large for it to work out this way?
It could work on all sizes. Many people actually assume that worker cooperatives in particular need to be smaller, especially with workers holding decision-making power.
Mm-hmm.
But actually some studies show that worker cooperatives tend to be a bit larger. So they could work with any size enterprise, from three-person enterprises to even one enterprise in Spain, Mondragon, which has about 80,000 worker owners.
Okay.
So all sizes can work, but the model itself does vary, of course.
So how does it work, though, when a company needs to do layoffs, when that's really something a company faces and you've got a group of worker owners? How would a decision like that be made then?
So there's been some interesting developments with that, and we've seen that in 2008 financial crisis. And Mondragon actually is a great example of this. At Mondragon, instead of laying off workers, what they decided to do was to collectively decide to cut everybody's working hours for a period of time so as to allow everyone to keep their job. Mm-hmm. Also, Mondragon itself is effectively a worker cooperative of cooperatives. And so what happened there was that when a business actually failed, one of its founding businesses from 1956, what ended up happening was that workers from that enterprise were retrained so that they could find another job within with somewhere else within the conglomerate. So worker cooperatives tend to respond this way.
You're talking about Mondragon? I'm not familiar with that company. What kind of company is that, Mondragon?
Mondragon, it's the third largest corporation in Spain. It's based in Basque Country, and it's a conglomerate that's across multiple industries, ranging from retail to pharmaceuticals to industrial to heavy and light industrial manufacturing, and on and on. It has about 110 enterprises, 110 worker cooperatives that make up the Mondragon Cooperative Corporation.
Do these kinds of worker ownership structures, do they work better in Europe than they have in the U.S.?
That particular kind of worker ownership structure has sometimes worked out better in Europe because of the legal structures that have been put in place. In the United States, it varies across different states. So some states do provide a better legal structure, such as being able to incorporate as a worker cooperative within the United States. Other states do not have statutes in place that allow for that to happen. So it's a bit more difficult and legally complicated. But it does vary.
How do work? Let's say you're a company of 30 workers. I mean, how do the finances work for these workers to be able to get the capital to buy a company outright?
So it can happen a few ways. There are, since cooperatives are becoming more popular in the United States, and since employee-owned businesses are, as I said, there are actually thousands of them across the country, gaining access to capital isn't always as difficult as it might be perceived. But some policies that have been put forward are the ideas of putting forward loan guarantees from municipalities as well as states, or setting up a state employee ownership fund or even national employee ownership fund. But that's something that policymakers need to decide on their own as to whether they want to do that. But there is capital available. The question is whether we will make it easier, especially if we are to resolve this jobs crisis that's about to emerge from the silver tsunami.
Yeah. I mean, are there challenges, though, that this kind of a structure faces when it comes to making fast decisions, difficult decisions when you're dealing with, you know, dozens of owners?
In many cooperatives, decision-making is certainly slower. But again, depending on how it's structured and according to the bylaws, according to the board and management structure, cooperatives can be flexible in terms of how they deal with crisis, especially, and how they deal with different decision-making items and opportunities. So things such as, for example, deciding on whether to contract or conduct a deal with an outside firm or client can be as simple as simply empowering and authorizing a worker owner to carry out that task. Okay. So there can be things that are done that allow individual owners within the enterprise to carry out work that allow for speedy decisions and speedy business management. But, of course, beyond a certain scope, the worker owners will collectively have to decide on certain things, and that might take more time.
Is that common, then, for these kinds of organizations to, rather than laying anybody off, to cut wages across the board, that kind of thing?
It is a common thing in terms of trying to cut hours temporarily and wait till output is restored. Many of the worker cooperatives that I'm familiar with have done things this way, where they sort of refuse, in fact, to lay off workers and find other ways to either expand their clientele, look into other industries, or simply wait out a period of a downturn.
Alexander Kolokotronis, he's a PhD student in poli-sci at Yale University. Alexander, great to have you on 1320 WILS. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Yep.